The lesson this morning is basically taken from 2 Corinthians. My son did some articles on these chapters. He's been doing some of those things. And I took some of the things that he talked about in them, and I'm sharing them with you today because life's filled with challenges. There are dangers all around us. There are difficulties that come up in our lives and challenge us at the most unexpected times. And I think some of the things that Paul says here in 2 Corinthians would help us to be able to deal with it. And I think if we deal with them in the way that Paul does, we will handle them well. And so that's really why I want to talk about 2 Corinthians this morning. Maybe more so are the challenges for Christians because there is also the challenge not of just life, but of living a Christ-like life. The reading this morning from 2 Corinthians chapter 1. And you might as well take out your Bibles, or if you have one, and if there's not one in front of you there in the pew, if you would, take it out. We're going to be spending most of our time in 2 Corinthians, and so if you'd like to follow along, you can do so in that way. In 2 Corinthians 1, in verses 8 and 9, and as we saw in the scripture reading this morning, Paul feels that his life is in danger, or was in danger at a certain point. And I think that's an interesting thing for us to think about, because there is the possibility that our lives as Christians could be put in danger. And in those times, people want to be encouraging. When we're going through difficult times, they want to be encouraging to us, and we should be. But sometimes people will say things like, God gives his toughest assignments to his strongest soldiers. Or they might say something like, when it rains, it pours. And I have no doubt that they're trying to be encouraging. But in those difficult times, in those challenging times, if my life's in danger, I'm not wanting to be strong anymore in that case. Lord, I'm asking, Lord, why do you think I'm strong, giving me these challenges? And there are some who might say, well, God, they'll never give you anything you can't handle. And they basically base that off of 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 13, which says, God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you're able. I don't really think that's what that passage is saying. You see, when you're broken and sore and beat down, I don't just need to try harder. That's kind of what that says to me. I understand God will not allow me to be tempted beyond my ability. But it goes on to say, with the temptation, he will provide a way of escape. He will find, I will have a way of handling that, of getting through that difficulty. It's not about trying harder. It's trying to be just like Christ. When I look at that verse in 2 Corinthians 1, those verses 8 and 9, let me ask you, what do you see in those verses? What's Paul saying to these Corinthians? I think what Paul's saying here, or what it seems apparent to me, is that he thought that it was the end. Death was just around the corner, so to speak. Death was hanging over him. And let me tell you, he's no weakling. But he admits that the difficulties they faced were beyond their strength. And I think that's a key in handling difficulties. Sometimes things happen in your life. Many years ago, I lost a daughter to SIDS. That was a very difficult time for both myself and Darlene. It was a challenge. And there were certainly times with that it was beyond our strength. Because I know Darlene told me one time that there were individuals she was working with at the nursing home that blamed us, that thought we were guilty of killing our daughter. That's a burden to bear. I'll tell you, it's beyond my strength. And I think about it, and I think, I can't do this. I think that's part of what Paul's saying. I can't do this. I don't know what I'm going to do. And maybe you, sitting in the pew this morning, are now crying out with this very same exasperation. I think you should take courage from what Paul says here. Because again, look at the text. What did Paul say those burdens did for him? They forced him to rely on God. I'm not strong enough, but God is infinitely capable. He can do this. And when children are small, their little legs will give out. They want to walk, they want to run. But when they've got all of that done, they're done. And they need to be picked up and carried. And so mom and dad will bend over and pick them up and carry them home. You are not the strongest soldier, and that's okay. Let your Father carry you. I think that's what Paul is telling us. That's what he did. He leaned on the Father because he didn't have the strength, but he knew who did. And that's important. I think there's another thing that I find in chapter 2 that I think is important. Look at verses 15 and 16 in chapter 2. It says, "For we are a fragrance of Christ to God among those who are being saved and among those who are perishing. To the one an aroma from death to death, to the other an aroma from life to life. And who is adequate for these things?" Make sure you smell like Jesus. I know another preacher who wrote a book, "They Smell Like Sheep." Well, a shepherd, when he walks among the sheep, is going to smell like the sheep. When you walk with Jesus, you should smell like Jesus. Right? Yeah, I think so. And I think that's what Paul's saying here to us. And I think it's an important thing for us to think about. I remember several years ago, my son Ray was telling about one of the girls saying that he smelt good. And so, of course, as any father would say, "Well, what do I smell like?" And she says, "Like Grandpa." And I thought, "Well, you're in good company, Ray." This passage, Paul has been forced to defend himself as an apostle to the Corinthians. This is the church that he himself had planted. How could they have forgotten him? It seems as strange as forgetting your mother's voice. And again, when Darlene died, I remember having a message from her that I would listen to just so I could hear her voice again. Now, I don't have that message any longer. But I still am sure that I would know her voice. Did you notice here that Paul defends himself and his group of ministers with this image of Jesus. He says they smell like Jesus. They smell like Jesus. Notice there again in these verses that's what he says. The funny thing about that word smell, it can be good or it can be bad. We pass 108th Street on Sunday mornings, every Sunday morning. And oftentimes when we pass 108th Street, the bakery there is cooking bread. And oh my, your mouth just waters going by there. You think about how good that bread is going to taste. But then contrast that with a boys' locker room after football practice. Not so good. Not so good. You see, the point I think Paul is making here is that to some, Paul was a fragrance of life, and to others, he was the stench of death. He was the same. He wasn't different to one than he was to the other, yet some loved him and others couldn't stand him. What I need to realize is that when I smell like Jesus, I may be off-putting to some because Jesus is also off-putting to them. But what I truly hope is when I'm with those who love Jesus, that they would think of me being like him. In chapter 3, in verses 1 and 2, we read, "Are we beginning to commend ourselves again, or do we need, as some, letters of commendation to you or from you? You are our letter, written in our hearts, known and read by all men." That letter of recommendation is a means of introduction. And what Paul's talking about is if he was traveling in a far off, as he's traveling in far off places and he meets a group of disciples, a letter from another group of disciples explaining who he is and his faithful conduct among them would offer Paul some credibility. But it seems by the time Paul writes this letter, he's fallen out of favor with these disciples at Corinth. And they refuse to acknowledge him or his role as an apostle without someone to vouch for him. Now that just really seems odd, since he planted the church and he worked with them and he established them. I think when you read this, you really recognize that Paul thinks this is a little crazy too. They expected this because, he expected this because he planted the church. And like he writes, they are, their very existence is his letter of recommendation. Did you ever have one of your children think that their teacher was smarter than you? I think that's kind of the idea here. Yeah? That teacher, they know all of these things and you don't know any of those things. I think that's the idea. That old adage that familiarity breeds contempt, or as Jesus said, a prophet has honor except in his hometown, Matthew 13:57. As I look back and I think about it, when my children were little, I was the hero. I was the strong one. I was the smart one. I knew all of these things that could be done and how they could be done. They trusted me because I was their dad. But if for some reason my children now as adults would look at me with suspicion, I'd be hurt. I think I would say, you know me. We share history. You are my letter of recommendation. You see, that, I think, is what Paul's talking about here. Much of what Paul writes in this letter is about relationships, about healing hurts and bandaging unity. Don't we all have some relational aches? What do you see in his attempt? And I think it's really important. I would encourage you to read the entire letter of 2 Corinthians. And think about things like this. How do you see his attempts to restore mutual love that might help us in our damaged relationships? Look at chapter 7, if you would, with me for just a second. Look at chapter 7. Let's begin at verse 2. Make room for us in your hearts. We wronged no one. We corrupted no one. We took advantage of no one. I do not speak to condemn you, for I have said before that you are in our hearts to die together and to live together. Great is my confidence in you. Great is my boasting on your behalf. I am filled with comfort. I am overflowing with joy in all our affirmation. For even when we came into Macedonia, our flesh had no rest, but we were afflicted on every side, conflicts without fear, fears within. But God, who comforts the depressed, comforted us by the coming of Titus, and not only by his coming, but also by the comfort which he was comforted in you, as he reported to us your longing and your mourning, your zeal for me, so that I rejoiced even more. And he goes on. He's bragging on them. He's thankful for them. Excuse me. That's how he's trying to repair that relationship. I'm mentioning all of these good things that he remembers and knows about them. Look at chapter 4. Chapter 4 and verse 7. But we have this treasure in earthen vessels, so that the surpassing greatness of the power will be of God and not from ourselves. I think it's important for us to remember we're just clay jars. Have you ever wondered why God chose to communicate the amazing message of salvation through ordinary men? In 2 Timothy 2 and verse 2, Paul writes this, "The things which you have heard from me in the presence of many witnesses, entrust these to faithful men who will be able to teach others also." Here is the idea of the propagation of the gospel. One man teaching another man, teaching another man, and on and on and on it goes. Why did God use ordinary man? God could have chosen any sort of grand means to communicate the gospel. Why men telling men? I can't explain God's reasoning, and so there is simply no reason for me to try. In Isaiah 55 and verse 9, Isaiah writes, "For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways and my thoughts than your thoughts." I have no way of knowing why God did it this way. But there must have been a really good reason. You see, are you not impressed with the resilient power of the gospel message? It has survived and thrived in spite of the preachers and the teachers. Those clay jars, some of them are cracked. Some are out of shape. These clay jars lack refinement. Even being cracked and damaged, they still hold the message of salvation. It is a testament to the conquering nature of the message that has spread around the world through its ministers, in spite of the fact that its ministers are weak and sinful themselves. The psalmist says in Psalm 8 and verse 2, "From the mouth of infants and nursing babes you have established strength." What that makes me think of is something my son wrote. To show God's overwhelming power, he could overtake the armies of the world with a horde of screaming babies. Wouldn't that be something to see? Yeah, I think so. Look at chapter 5, verse 12. Chapter 5 and verse 12. "We are not commending ourselves to you again, but giving you an opportunity to be proud of us, so that you may have a reply for those who take pride in outward appearance rather than in the heart." I titled this with, "When Brethren Are Embarrassed by You." In this letter, Paul is writing to his spiritual children. He planted the church at Corinth, as we said. But so many of them seem to be embarrassed by Paul. In their view, he doesn't measure up to the other teachers that have come through Corinth. He's poor. He's not an eloquent speaker. Some people claim that the impediment that he had in the flesh was his oratory ability. But whether that's true or not, I don't know. But he was not an eloquent speaker. He's kind of like me. I don't speak that eloquently. The other teachers brag about their Jewish roots. Look over in chapter 11. In chapter 11 and in verse 22. "Are they Hebrews? So am I. Are they Israelites? So am I. Are they descendants of Abraham? So I." So they've been bragging about their Jewish heritage, haven't they? The visions they've received, they've been bragging about them as well. In chapter 12 and in verse 1, "Boasting is necessary, though it is not profitable, but I will go on to visions and revelations of the Lord." And so they've been boasting about those kind of things as well. In chapter 12 and down in verses 11 through 13, I have become foolish. You yourselves compel me. Actually, I should have been commended by you, for in no respect was I inferior to the most eminent apostle. Even though I am a nobody, the signs of a true apostle were performed among you with all perseverance by signs and wonders and miracles. For in what respect were you treated as inferior to the rest of the churches, except that I myself did not become a burden to you? Forgive me this wrong. Yeah. So they've bragged about their performance of miracles and so forth. And now the Corinthian church is looking down on Paul. I think the important thing to remember here is that Paul is not inferior to any one of these in any area. And I think that's part of what he says here in this letter. He has not bragged about them because they're not what he values. Those things are of no importance. And in fact, he says that he considers them as rubbish. Things that ought to be thrown out on the manure pile. You see, what Paul values is his likeness to a crucified Jesus and that God knows him. These are the two things that are truly important and should be important to us. To be in the likeness of a crucified Jesus and to know that God knows him. These are the marks that have value. You see, I want my children and my grandchildren to be proud of me. I want my siblings, my church family to respect me. It would hurt me to disappoint them or to know that I embarrassed them. I don't have impressive achievements. I'm not a college graduate. I've not been to seminary. I've driven old vehicles for the most part of my life. I've lived in modest homes almost all of my life. I come from simple people, hard-working Midwestern farmers, and I can tell you about digging post holes in the middle of August in the southern Illinois countryside in that hard clay in the middle of August. It was no fun. I have no claims on greatness the way some count greatness. I fathered six precious children. I've served a few small churches and intertwined my heart with theirs. I've made friends that are good company for life's road trip. If I can give them any reason to think well of me or to be proud of me, I want it to be exactly the same thing that Paul wanted. The image of a sacrificed Jesus alive and well in me. Lastly, look at 2 Corinthians 6. In 2 Corinthians 6, in verses 3 and 4, giving no cause for offense in anything, so that the ministry will not be discredited, but in everything, commending ourselves as servants of God in much endurance, in affliction, in hardships, in distresses. As I continue reading the chapter, Paul enumerates his challenging life circumstances. And I think the main point that he is making is that he won't let the circumstances of his life dictate his commitment to Jesus. And sometimes we have that problem of allowing life to dictate our commitment to Jesus. Think about, as you read this chapter and the things that Paul suffered through, think about that and how that compares to your life. When I think about it, I think, boy, I've had an easy life in comparison to that. No matter the hardships or the joys, if he's being praised or even if he's being lied about, that's not going to affect his dedication to Jesus Christ. In your walk with Jesus, what has been the biggest challenge? I want you to think about this. What's been the biggest challenge to your faithfulness? Think about it. What has challenged your faithfulness? Is it when life is peaceful or chaotic? Is it easier to stay close to God when people are abusive or kind? Is it harder to remember God humbly when everyone has a good word about you or when the words aren't so nice? You see, I'm not looking for a set answer. I just want you to take some time and I want you to reflect on your answer. And if you find weakness, then pray. Pray about it. Deal with it in that way. That's what Paul did. I encourage you to read the book of 2 Corinthians, to reflect on the challenges that Paul faced and how he dealt with each of them, then put it all into practice. Put it into practice. Live your life in that way. And I guarantee you, Jesus will be pleased and you will be reflecting the glory of the Son of God to those around you and in the world. If your life is not what it needs to be this morning, we would encourage you to change it now. James says in chapter 4 and verse 14 that our life is like a vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes away. We were just talking about this just this week, about the very idea that no one is guaranteed the next day. I told him, one of these days I'm not going to be here. I'm going to be dead. And you're going to have to go on without me. That could be today. It could be tomorrow. It may be a year from now. But it's coming. And on that day, there's only going to be one thing that's going to matter. Is am I right with God? If you're not, won't you come as we stand and sing the song that was selected?